You're listening to the Marketplace Flash Briefing. I'm Kai Rizdal. 6 months ago to this very day, the Russian army and Russian air and missile forces invaded Ukraine. To date, including the $3 billion package the White House announced today, the United States has given Kyiv a little more than $13 billion in aid and arms. This is now, it seems, a war of attrition, in which the economic realities in Russia and in Ukraine are going to become more relevant the longer it lasts. So we've gotten Dr. Kristi Ironside back on the phone. She's an assistant professor of Russian history at McGill University. We've gotten her on the phone to talk things over. Dr. Ironside, welcome back.
Great to chat with you again, Kai.
So when we spoke 6 months ago today, actually, one of the things we talked about was the sanctions effort and trying to cut Russia basically out of the global economy. With the understanding that you're a professor of history, not a professor of economics, do you think that's happened?
Well, yes and no. Yes, in the sense that many different firms have pulled out of the Russian market. At this point, I think the count is up to around 1,000. So McDonald's pulled out, Starbucks, all these kinds of companies have left. So in that sense, Russia is definitely very economically isolated. But in another very important sense, it's not, in the sense that it is still selling oil and gas to the rest of the world, particularly to Europe. So it's still connected in that very important way.
And that's manifesting actually in the ruble, too, right? When we talked last time, the ruble had cratered is the only word to think of it. And now it's not only stable, but back to where it was like in 2014 or something.
Absolutely. This has been one of the really surprising things that has happened since that. In part, the reason it's happening is because right now there is no demand for products in US dollars, in euros within Russia itself, because it is so cut off from the world economy. And it's also happening because the Russian government has implemented de facto capital controls. So it's forcing Gazprom, its, you know, energy provider, to repatriate its profits in rubles. So it's generating demand for the ruble, which is helping to keep the ruble up behind the scenes.
Let me just take it sideways for a second, just because you mentioned Gazprom and natural gas obviously is a huge story in Europe. Prices are up here as well in the States. Winter's coming, as the saying goes, and natural gas is going to get more dear. And that's only going to benefit the Russians, right, and the Russian government.
They're definitely counting on this. I think this is one of their strategies, is they're trying to promote this disunity that's in Europe around this issue. Yeah. They're counting on people not wanting to pay more to heat their homes when it gets colder in a couple of months' time, and that putting domestic pressure on governments to ease those sanctions.
Are you in contact with people in Russia, whether Moscow or elsewhere?
I am.
What are they telling you?
I mean, to be honest, the people that I have still in Russia are quite guarded, but a lot of my friends and colleagues have left. I have a lot of people who now are living in Serbia, in Georgia, in Armenia, you know, maybe hopefully not permanently. A lot of them, of course, want to go back. Their home is there, but they're very worried. They don't know what to do in the short term. And these are people who don't support the government or who, you know, are just extremely horrified by what's going on. So it's a very complicated situation at the moment for everybody involved.
I went back and I listened to the interview that you and I did at the end of February. And the last question I asked you was what you thought it might take for the Russian population to, and look, granting all the repression and hardball tactics that the Putin government engages in, I asked you what you thought it would take for the Russian people to say, that's it, we don't want this anymore. Are you surprised the Russian people have lasted 6 months?
Yes and no. I mean, I think part of it is that we're still seeing them being sheltered from a lot of this. This isn't to say that people don't understand this is happening, but their information world is very different than ours. Let's put it like that. And again, I always keep saying this, but I think it's really worth remembering. Russia's a very big place. It's very diverse. And the kinds of people that I interact with, I have a very urban life when I go to Russia. I live in Moscow. Mm. My friends, my colleagues are there. My archives are there. But it's a very different world than when you're out in the provinces, when you're in some of these smaller places where they're less connected to, you know, global chains like McDonald's or things like this. So if you're a young IT professional in Moscow, this is disastrous to your living standards, and less so to somebody living in Siberia.
Right.
So we're still watching this happened kind of in slow motion, and I'm not entirely sure where it's all headed, if I'm being perfectly honest.
Look, you're the expert, so if you don't know, I don't know who's gonna. Let me ask you one last thing, and then I'll get out of your hair. If I call you when I call you in 6 months, and this invasion and war now are a year old, what are you going to be looking for between now and then? What are you looking at?
I'll be looking at what's going on domestically in the economy. If prices continue to rise in Russia, inflation is definitely affecting them. So the fact that the ruble is doing fine is a very imperfect measure of living standards, because of course you can't buy dollars in Russia right now. You can't, you know, easily engage in trade. And I'll also be watching brain drain. This is another thing that's going on right now. Lots of young people are leaving. I read statistics this morning that we're talking about potentially millions of people who have left since this started. So those are things that I'll be watching for.
Dr. Kristi Ironside, she's an assistant professor of history, Russian history rather, at McGill University up in Montreal. Professor Ironside, thanks for your time. I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Kai.
Wherever you fall on the spectrum of whether it was a good idea or not, the announcement today from President Biden that he's canceling some student debt, while a big deal for millions of Americans, does kind of dodge the root cause. Higher education in this country is incredibly, and that's putting it politely, expensive. In the past 50 years, tuition at both public and private schools has more than tripled. That's even after accounting for inflation. So Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reminds us now why tuition is so high.
Heidi Graham feels slightly ill when she thinks about the $83,000 she paid for her son to attend NYU just for this year.
The most my parents ever paid in tuition was $801, and I'm not that old. I mean, I'm 52.
Graham went to a public college in California. NYU is private, and her son wants to work in film.
Those particular careers, a lot of it is who you know. And it does help you to go to a more exclusive school, or you hope. Maybe I've bought into what everybody's selling.
One thing schools are selling, the faculty. Catherine Hill's an economist with the education nonprofit Ithaca SNR. She's also the former president of Vassar College. She says the wages faculty and administrators command have gone up in recent years.
If you break down costs, about 60 to 70% of costs are driven by compensation for people that work at institutions.
Colleges also provide more stuff than they did 50 years ago, like mental health services and career counseling.
Very large shares of the applicants are willing and able to pay those prices. If they weren't, schools wouldn't be charging them.
Public college prices are less eye-watering, but still way higher than they used to be. That's because those colleges get less money from the government now. Betsy Mayotte is president of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors.
All the states have deinvested in higher education.
Mayotte says colleges should have a bigger stake when it comes to the loans that students take out.
If it was up to me, I would hold schools accountable for anybody that defaulted on their loans within 10 years of leaving the school.
One downside of that is people who need to borrow might be less likely to be admitted in the first place. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
That's all for today's Flash Briefing. For more news, visit marketplace.org.